involved? What are the facilities that show you? Why doesn't he answer the person to do whatever he wants, and there shouldn't be any problem at all? He's on halacha or on a shofar, there shouldn't be any question whatsoever. This is called pikuach nefesh. We're trying to save the guy's life. It may not work, and he may lose something, but why not? The problem is a problem for a very obvious reason, to use the off-quote phrase of the Radbaz, a nafshu shalom kinyonei or kinyonei shalom kinyonei. A man does not have the right to dispose of his life as he chooses. He's bound by the Gedorim of Halacha. Then if he is bound by the Gedorim of Halacha and he has no proprietary interest in his life or indeed even in his body, then what are his obligations? Why does he have to seek medication and therapy in the first place? It seems to me that a person has a certain relationship to his life and to his body, which is unique to his life and his body, and imposes certain responsibilities, obligations, and with it, if you really view it from a certain perspective, certain privileges and prerogatives. He is a shamer. He had clearly shmir. The eventually gave him a pikotin, a very precious pikotin, it's called life. And when the time comes, he must restore it, but he restores it when the master comes and wants it back. In the meantime, he has an obligation of shmir. He is supposed to preserve it in the state in which it has been granted to him. Now, that results in a quandary. It results in a quandary in Hilchos Shomrim in other contexts, and it results in a quandary in Hilchos Refuah, which is a kind of a subcategory of Hilchos Shomrim on this vantage point, on this perspective. The individual who has a pikotin, and if he does nothing, the pikotin will go to ibud, has an obligation to prevent it from going to ibud, even if it will result in a possible financial loss. Shamer on payers and the subject to recover. He can't simply keep the payers and can't keep the apples until it all rot. He has to dispose of them and in order to preserve the pikotin that has been entrusted to him. And what is his obligation of shmir? The obligation is to the master Yinche. He has to use the discretion of a prudent man. There are standards to which the shamer is held. In terms of pikuach nefesh, what do you anticipate that the person is going to do? It turns out that the question then is a question of whether a certain gamble is prudent in order to benefit the owner of this valuable property, in order to benefit the Rebbeinu Elohim who owns all life. I am acting on behalf of the Creator in preserving the Pekot. Some gambles are acceptable, some gambles are not acceptable, or some gambles may not be acceptable, and there may be a broad area in which there is discretion. The shamer has to gamble sometimes. Now, let me use that model, and I don't intend to stretch the analogy in a very precise way, but I think that it serves as a useful model. What does the Rebbeinu Shloim want? The Rebbeinu Shloim wants the maximization of life. And if you will allow me to coin an expression, I will call it life quanta. The quanta of life. Every moment of life is discrete. And the Rebbeinu Shloim wants the maximization of these life quanta. If you want to know what is it that I should be concerned about, and how does a prudent individual respond when he is called upon to make a decision with regard to the weighing of Chayei Shor against Chayei Tzivu, it makes sense to say that the person should act in a way that will maximize the life quanta given the vagaries of the situation. Let me give you an analogy. Let us assume that I have entree to a casino in Las Vegas or Atlantic City. I have unlimited numbers of $10 bills, and I can go to the roulette table or the slot machine, and the house gives me a return of 10 to 1. I get $100 for every $10 bet if I win. and I'm given a situation in which the odds are against me 10 to 1. 10 to 1 odds that I lose. But the return on the gamble is 10 to 1, and I have an unlimited number of $10 bills. Question, shall I gamble or shall I not gamble? Any mathematician will tell you that this is not called gambling, this is called a harmless pastime. It may be deleterious, it may be a waste of time, but I'm not going to walk away a winner or a loser. If you have enough time and enough $10 bills and you pay the slot machine 10 to 1 against you, but the return is 10 to 1 on your gamble, mathematically, you're going to walk out even when this is all over. That's not called a gamble. That's called a pastime. Mr. Trump is a hard-headed businessman. He is not a gambler. In Trump's, what's it called, Trump's palace, whatever it is there, he isn't gambling. Forget about what implications may be in terms of who he is and whether it's mother or whether it's author. Maybe there are implications, maybe there aren't. He knows exactly how much money he is going to make every single day and every single week. Or better, he knows the percent of profit. He doesn't know how many people are going to show up, but he knows what percent profit he's going to have on the growth. That's because in his casino, the odds aren't 10 to 1 against you, the odds are 11 to 1 against you. You get a return of 10 to 1, but the odds are 11 to 1 against you, and that's the house's margin of profit. He is definitely going to win, and you are definitely going to lose. A person who gambles under those circumstances is called a fool. A gambler is a fool. They're bound to lose. No matter that somebody may walk out winning, that's a kind of a fluke. But anybody who does this over a continued period of time, the mathematician will assure them that he is going to lose. Let's take the flip side of the coin. The person goes to the casino, he gets 10 to 1 return on his, quote, gamble, but the chances are only, the odds are against him only 9 to 1. The guy who bets under those circumstances isn't a gambler, he's a shrewd businessman, he's Mr. Trump. He's got a guarantee of winning. Under those circumstances, he has an absolute guarantee of winning if he plays the game long enough. Now, if we take that and put it into a therapeutic model, we have the following situation. You have a doctor, he has an unlimited number of patients, and they all suffer from the same disease. And he has one therapy for all the patients. They all come to him, they've got exactly, left untreated. They have exactly 10 days to live. If they are treated, they will all live 100 days, if the therapy works. If the therapy doesn't work, they die on the spot. Each patient is gambling 10 days of chayishura against 100 days of life. Now, this doctor, if we're dealing with a situation in which only 1 out of 10 patients is going to survive, and if survived, he will survive 100 days, and the other 9 are going to die on the spot, in terms of the life quanta, you can multiply it up. You've got a 10% chance of 100 days. That means that you have, in this equation, 10-day life quanta. And 10 patients. 9 of these patients are going to lose 10 days. One of them is going to get 100 days. It'll work out to a wash in terms of life quantum. If you change the odds just a little bit in favor of the patient, if successful, is going to live not 100 days, but 110 days, but if it doesn't work, he's going to die on the spot. We have maximized the life quanta. There's going to be more life from the transcendental vantage point. There are more life quanta have been brought into existence by using this medicine than if the doctor surrenders his license and doesn't practice medicine. That sounds as if it's a kind of a prudent investment. If the odds have changed up a little bit and they're against the patient, the ones who are treated and will survive will live only 90 days instead of 100 days. The number of life quanta will be diminished as a result of this therapy, since all the others are going to die on the spot. They're not even going to have their 10 days. So we have we have minimized to the point of zero the life point of all those people, and even this person turns out isn't going to live long enough to compensate for the loss to the other nine patients who are going to die on the spot. That sounds like a bad example. It sounds as if this is what is operating when you are making this type of analysis with regard to Chayishua against Chayishiu. Now, on this analysis, it's not so much Chayishua against Chayishiu, some clearly defined notion of Chayishua as X number of days, weeks, and months, is whether it's a prudent gamble. Given the risks involved, is it prudent or isn't it prudent? If you're dealing with a person who has only Jaina Yimayan to live, but if it works, then he lives 70 years, sounds as if that exact risk is a much more cogent and acceptable risk than if you're dealing with a patient who, if successful, is only going to live a week anyway, and not just gambling a day. Is it worthwhile gambling one day for 70 years? It sounds as if it is a prudent gamble, even if the odds are very much against you, even if there's a 70% chance in the last spot. 70% chance of losing one day as against a 30% chance of gaining 70 years. Whereas if you're dealing with one day against a week or a month, and you have a 90% chance of losing, it doesn't make very much sense to take that kind of gamble. It seems to me that the paradigm is something of that nature. Now remember, Chazal did not talk in the language of the statistician. We don't have statistics. In halacha, we know about arrays and the mute, and even the mute of the muses, but you don't have this notion of a very rigidly defined statistic that can be applied mathematically in any given case. And that's for good reason. Because in Trump's power, I have an unlimited number of $10 bills. When you're dealing with life, there's only one life and only one throw of the dice. If you win, it's wonderful, but if you lose, you don't get a second chance. And that's why you don't find this kind of strict paradigm. Sorry.
It seems to me that it's a very analogy would make this sort of analogy not applicable, because we can't total up 100 people cutting Shah and say that's equivalent to one person cutting you, or whatever the numbers are. In other words, maybe it's not relevant to say that that's the case. In other words, we're always discussing one person cutting Shah against the possibility of that person cutting you.
Correct. That was the last point that I made. That this person has only one life and one throw of the dice. Yeah, he can't recoup his loss. If you turn to the Shushankid, answers, after Vale Hashim Makai Shura, Philly Mishapar, who gave his mammoth, who may high time in patience with Hoya, so Kai Gab, the time alone, the Mutlakal Shabbos, Makai Shura, Kasherak, and Shushankid, Selkas, and Jimmo, Miko Mok, and the Mutli Don Chef, Shre, Yafu, Zu, Yisrap, and the Gamrei, The Shushankid says that you have the right to jeopardize Chayishua for Chayishium. After consulting with Reis Deis Reisim, you need a second, third, and fourth opinion, and then the Hashkomas Chokom Shebuyir. The point of the Shushankid is that you do have the right to gamble Chayishua, and the Raiyus Teodim Anidim at the Gemara Rabo Mitzeroyim, they were facing certain death from starvation. They say they'll go to Machna Arom. Either they'll be killed on the spot because they're the enemy, and they will not have even the Chayishua, which a person dying of starvation still has, and will live for a short while, till the body gives out. And the gamble is that they will be Rachamoni, they'll take pity on them and give them food, and then they will have normal longevity anticipation. Now that's the kind of a case in which it's probably impossible to quantify what the odds are. You do know the downside. You do know how long the Chayishua is, but you don't know the chances of success. And my real problem is, what is the function of the Chacham Shevuyir? What does the Chacham know that the Reishim don't know? The Reishim are the ones who are going to assess the medical situation. They're going to tell us what the chances of survival are. They'll tell us how long the Chai Shur that is being gambled may be. And they're going to tell us whether it's prudent or not prudent. What's the function of the Chacham Shevuyir? It seems to me that the Chacham Shevuyir, at least in part, is here to decide whether the gamble is a prudent gamble or not. And even if we cannot quantify the prudency in a strictly mathematical way, the Chacham Shevuyir is going to tell you that if you are gambling years, you're going to be gambling months of life for a chance of success that is extremely slim, that this is not a prudent gamble. Now, what is called extremely slim? I think it depends upon the circumstances. Sometimes, and again, I don't think there's ever a strict mathematical definition, but I think that a prudent person will know whether the gamble is in the ballpark or whether the gamble is not in the ballpark, and at that point it becomes discretionary as far as the failure is concerned. Now, let me make just one or two minor points. One is that there's at least one Akron. I've never seen it inside. I can't find the paper. It's the Mishnah Chachamim cited by the Achiezer. The Mishnah Chachamim says that you need at least a 50% chance of success. If there is less than a 50% chance of success, you have no right to gamble even Chayishur. Other Achronim, including the Sanfleser, make no such stipulation. They say that even one chance out of 100, maybe one out of 1,000, is good enough to gamble Chayishur in at least some circumstances. Point number two, it seems to me that in all situations, this gamble of Chayishur for a return called Chayishur is discretionary and never obligatory. That there is no absolute obligation to gamble Chayishur in order to secure a refuah shlemim. Now, there are some sources that seem to contradict that. It was mentioned in at least one place. It seems to say that there is more than a 50% chance of success is mandatory. The more it sees, I showed you last time, that says that you've got to amputate the limb. Certainly, in the medical context that he was writing, I don't think that there was any guarantee that he would save the person's life. Even today, amputations are dangerous. They may not be as dangerous as they were once upon a time, but they certainly remain dangerous. Yet the Merkleia seems to think that the amputation was obligatory, even though it carried with it the danger of losing Chayishur, but that it was obligatory in order to save the life of the individual. Revelation in one place, and I think it may be contradicted by others, seems to imply that when chances of success are more than 50%, that this becomes mandatory. I'm not sure. Certainly the Mishnah Chachamim doesn't seem to say that. The Mishnah Chachamim seems to say that when it's more than 50%, it's permissible. He doesn't say that it's always obligatory. Less than 50%, he seems to say, is forbidden. And it may be that even more than 50% is only permissible. But that will then lead us to another problem, which I'll come to after the question. Yes.
So is this trying to quantify what the previous man would do? It's clear that under certain treatment, let's say that a blood transfusion, where one could say that...
That's my next point. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
How does it affect, say, operations to improve quality of life on the
That I haven't talked about at all. Operations to improve quality of life as distinct from longevity are discussed by the same Morris Clear. The Morris Clear has difficulty justifying them. He was dealing with a procedure that he thought would only increase the quality of life, not life anticipation, and he has negative comments to make about people who put themselves into that situation. The first page, the paragraph that begins, Avoyesh Shabir from the Club of the Koshis, Say Lachim Atmon in Fury Koshin. So it's going to make some Atmon last person may even Shebekit, the Shebekit, the chata hakoyos, gallbladder operations, kidney stone operations, he thought that there was no threat to life. Forget about the medical reality. You have to take this hypothetical. People go for gallbladder operations only because they get gallbladder attacks, that's just painful. 13, Does that sound equivocal enough? He begins by saying that the Hushul Atmon and Leshakir Avde, Lojuta, that sounds like very negative language, Lojuta, that's not permissible. He begins with a Nisr, Lojuta is not permissible, means it's also. And then he says, Lefichach Lojuta Legamre Afilu Bechor. It's not completely permissible, what's that mean? Now he clearly is saying that he has difficulty justifying this. What's the math here? Who says it's Nisr? People are doing it. But we use the Lagamba. You know, Pukhazima Madabur, but he doesn't know the head. That's how I read the Lord's speech. He thinks it's also that everybody's doing it. He's saying, oh, must have something to be friend upon. I think I can explain what the friend upon. And that takes me to the first problem, and that is that if what we said before was correct, and that everything which is hazardous is discretionary and not mandatory, then if that's pushed to its extreme, no refuah is ever obligatory. In the language of the Ramban, we say it's Odom, in Lufasam, Shemarat, Luzer, She'en, Neni, Luzer. Any medicine, if it's potent enough to cure, can also kill. Aspirin are dangerous. They're extremely dangerous for some people. Fortunately, they are also very potent and they have cured a lot of other people. Does that mean that if you're running 106 fever and the doctor says that 106 fever is dangerous and the therapy of choice is the aspirin, that you've right to say I refuse the aspirin because some people, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 100,000, 1 in 1,000,000, some people have died as a result of an overdose of aspirin or even a minimal dose of aspirin? And the answer is clearly not. You just have to define what is called the sakana in halacha. And that is really an entirely different topic, but I'll try to deal with it in a sentence or two, or maybe three. And that is, it seems to me that any sakana is also a technical term in halacha. It's got its own definition. There's a threshold level of sakana. Anything which is not in the category of shem esprayim Hashem is a sakana. If it's in the category of shem esprayim Hashem, it's not a sakana by definition, even though it's clearly dangerous. What is called dangerous in Webster's dictionary is not the same as what is called a sakone in halacha. Shame of Soyin has its own categories and ramifications which are best analyzed in the context of a discussion which could be a Gimel Noshim. What it means is that I will oversimplify it. What is accepted by people as being safe and not as being hazardous. Things that people do because they do not consider them to be hazardous is in halacha not considered hazardous. It is clearly dangerous to cross not only 5th Avenue and 42nd Street, but even 186th Street and Amsterdam Avenue. Traffic accidents occur. Somebody is suffering from a life-threatening malady, and the doctor's office is across the street. And he say that he doesn't want to cross the office, he crossed the street to go to the office because traffic accidents occur with statistical probability, and this is a sakana. The answer is shame of story. What shame of story means? People don't consider that taking their lives in their hands every time they cross 185th Street and Amsterdam Avenue, or even 42nd Street and 5th Avenue, even though the statistician knows that it's dangerous. Sure, it's dangerous. But people ignore that danger in daily life. Dangers that are ignored in daily life don't count as dangers in halacha. Now, if you want to apply that in the medical context, I'm not sure how to apply it in every different case. Is the statistical risk of general anesthesia bichlal shem etzoyim, or is not bichlal shem etzoyim? there was a time when it was clearly not in the category of shameless study. People recognized that general anesthesia was dangerous, and they were afraid of it. That wasn't shameless study, and I'm not concerned with what the statistical risk might have been. Is this today in the category of shameless study? Is it not in the category of shameless study? I'm not absolutely certain. Maybe it is, maybe it is. I don't think it's relevant for our purposes. I'm taking that simply as an example. There are an aspirin for the treatment of fever, I think, is in the category of shameless study. Nobody really believes, not a matter of belief, no one perceives, I think the word is perception. No one perceives the aspirin as being dangerous, even though the pharmacologist knows very well that it's dangerous. That is a danger which is not perceived as being a danger, and same shame or soybean is in the eyes of the beholder.
So, hypothetically, then, according to the brochure, who says that more than a 50% probability of longevity of life function makes it the when exactly, what does that mean in terms of a prudent, how does that fit in with what we're saying, the prudent minimum summer that's not there for everyone to,
It doesn't. If you take this yardstick, it's not a 50% yardstick. This means that if it is perceived as being dangerous, then it's by definition discretionary. If it is not perceived as being dangerous, then it is by definition not discretionary,
so
mandatory.
So even a 70% chance of survival is perceived by people.
Absolutely, right. If 70% survival chance is perceived as being dangerous, and I think if you perceive 70% risk in major surgery as being dangerous, then it seems to me that it's the category of shameless story, and the patient has the right to decline this surgical procedure because it is perceived as being hazardous. Yes. Yes.
So it depends on patient probability. I would think that it should not, because, for example, everybody, people are afraid of flying airplanes, even though there's a probability of getting hurt in airplanes less than the last car.
That may be.
What I'm saying is that something like a surplus on should not be defined by the statistical probability of danger.
No. Shameless throwing is not defined by statistical probability. Shameless throwing is defined by perception. And the perception may not be related to statistical probability at all, however, one caveat. And that's the Bingham, who seems to say that whenever the statistical probability is more than 50%, by definition, it's not shameless throwing. When the risk to life is more than 50%, then by definition it may not be shameless throwing. I don't think very many people would regard it as shameless throwing, but you know, I think that there's a clear statement in the museum that a more than 50% risk is unacceptable under any and all circumstances.
People said it's only shameless.
Yes, they did.
And
they were, when they said it, they were right. Whether they are still right is a debatable point. I think that smoking is directly on point. As long as it's true that smoking is dangerous. Nobody ever said smoking, well, everyone in recent years has recognized that smoking is dangerous. So is aspirin. And so is crossing the street even for frivolous purposes.
So the smoking may be 50%?
It may. It may exceed 50%. I'm not sure. I haven't gone through the last batch of articles. But in the earlier batches of articles, I did not find proof positive that it exceeded 50%. At the point that it exceeds 50%, it seems to me that 50% of all smokers have decreased longevity anticipation. It seems to me that it's absolutely up there for the Bingham theorem. And the other point is shown the strain has nothing to do with statistics, it has to do with the perception. Do people perceive it as being dangerous or don't they? A few years ago, I would have said people certainly do not perceive it as being dangerous. A few years from now, I suspect I will tell you that there's no question everybody does perceive it as dangerous, only a fool smokes. Today, I'm not sure anymore. I think, you know, we're on a continuum. Right now, I don't know whether it's the Flausher and the Sturm or not the Flausher and the Sturm. I do know that when Rav Moshe wrote it, it definitely was the Flausher and the Sturm. No, that's the truth. You just mentioned one line and three lines of citation, Shemus Goyim, and then every place in Shas you find the concept of Shemus Goyim. one other source that is relevant to this, and that's the Sefer Chassidim. Sefer Chassidim makes a very negative statement about certain women who gave refuahs that killed people on the spot. I suspect that they must have cured some people also, otherwise nobody would have taken these things. But you're dealing with something that sounds very, very much analogous to what she said, and what she said is that this is entirely permissible, it's discretionary to be sure, but nevertheless permissible, not author. The Sefer Chassidim seems to say that this is author. And the question is, what is the shot in the Sefer Chassidim? Well, the first way that some upbringing deal with the Sefer Chassidim is to say that the women were dispensing this medication in situations in which a qualified physician had some other less dangerous refuah available. And as such, that makes a lot of sense. You don't use a refuah that is a sakana when there is an equally efficacious refuah around that is not dangerous. There's another shot or explanation or analysis of the Sefer Chassidim that presented by Rav Wellner in an article that appeared in Hatzarav HaMedina many years ago, putting aside the Sefer Chassidim, his analysis of Sefer Chassidim raises an interesting issue. He says that the Sefer Chassidim was dealing with a hazardous procedure, but it just wasn't any old hazardous procedure. That what these women were using was a refuge in a Taduka that was also hazardous. Last week we spoke about a refuge Taduka that wasn't a danger. It was just a refuge Taduka, it was a refuge in a Taduka. The question is, you obligated to use it? Can you use it on Shabbos if it involves suicides? Can you use it if it involves Machol HaPasur? And Rod Wellner poses in his analysis of Sefer Chassidim the interesting question of whether it is permissible to use a refuge in a Taduka, which is also dangerous. And he says that is what the Sefer Chassidim is talking about. Shushanki, the talks about a refuah beduka. This doctor has the medicine in his black bag. He has used it on some patients. And guess what? Some died on the spot, but others lived to ripe old age. That's called a refuah beduka. He knows that it works. The refuah beduka he saw last time doesn't mean it's guaranteed to work all the time, but it works at least some of the time. What the women were using, says Rav Wellner, was not a refuah beduka. However, we defined the refuah beduka last time, and in addition not being a refuah beduka, it also carried with it risk. And that, he says, is also a refuah. And the beduka, which is also hazardous, is also. And that clearly has implications in halacha. An experimental procedure may be entirely permissible, albeit not mandatory, so long as there are no issues involved. But what if it is dangerous to the bargain? At that point, according to Rav Wellner's analysis of Sefer Chassidim, it would be awesome. I have a serious problem with that. My problem is the source. The source of the whole concept of Chayishor in Chayishim, the Gemara of the Avor Mitzrayim, was that a refuah beduka or a refuah shein beduka? These people are going to Matna Aron. Do they know whether these people are rachamonim or inom rachamonim? Has anybody been waiting for them to see that at least sometime on Monday and Thursday they're rachamonim, the other day or the opposite? They're observing on Monday and Thursday, the rest of the week they're rachamonim. Sometimes they're rachamonim, sometimes rachamonim. This is a classic end of the duku. We know nothing about these people. What's the difference if I have a medication? I don't know if it works or doesn't work. Or I have a person, I don't know whether he works or doesn't work. Is he maracking on starving people, or isn't he maracking on starving people? If God seems as if we were dealing with a refuah shein of the duka, that was also the duka. We know the sakana. The sakana is at war. We're the enemy. And they kill enemies. The sakana is known, and we don't know whether it is the duka in any sense of the term the duka, or at least so it seems to me. But I simply give you that as one of the unresolved problems. And as you've discovered in this whole area, there are many, many unresolved problems. Any more points with regard to this?
Just a last point. It could be that there are countries like the United States or something like that, which is the only other case that they have had in many cases before the people over the world.
In Machna Aron, when the first group of starving people goes over and they're given a piece of bread and a glass of water, I have no problems with the second group. for the second group it's a refusal duty. Of course there's no guarantee that these people are not in our own are going to keep on handing out sandwiches. They need to decide enough is enough, and we don't need them anymore, so there's certainly not about that. But at that point it became a refusal duty because we thought they didn't prove some people. At that point it becomes a refusal duty. My problem was that Dalton and Siroyan were the first ones to try this.
Yeah, but
they're involved in the experimental protocol. Never before in the history of Machnah Rom did they find the Siroyan were enemies who were starving who came to ask for love to work. But yeah, what are you going to compare it to? Because you think there was a historical pressure and it
occurred. There was a historical
pressure. Fine, I find no evidence of that. No reason to believe that there was. No, Chazal weren't Magal with that stuff. And this becomes the paradigm for the halachas of Chayitur. And then, you know, all the Persians take that Gemara, and the Gemara takes it as the paradigm which establishes the license to put yourself in Sakonin in order to affect the cure. It applies it to those who are raised by a goy, who's supposed to have zoning, and if you're dealing with something whose body is going to die, he doesn't go to the doctor, he's allowed to. Gemara clearly in context is saying, I've got tied to it, and I'm gambling it because this guy may kill me, and what's my license to do it? The Avot Siroyim. Now, it sounds as if it's giving you the paradigm, even for a refuah chain of the Gugah. So it would seem to me. I see no evidence to the contrary. And if they wanted to limit it, then why didn't the Gemara show me there's a limitation upon it? That applies only because in this case there was some previous Gugah of one form or another that renders it a refuah Gugah. Yes, I, there was one point I should have made before. And that is, I said that the more serious things have difficulty in justifying an operation to improve quality of life. It seems to me that to the extent that there is authority for this, it comes from Rafa Yerapa and the Ramban. The Ramban says that the Zemuchor son, Shemarfa was there when the Mamish was there, and the Chiyuv of Rafa Yerapa is not limited to cases of the Gross Nefesh. Rapi Rapi is less to the growth method. In fact, he's just the rest of the Rapi, it doesn't mean only in the case of the growth method. And in terms of other mamazis, the Nechbal may not have been in mortal danger. And the race has the right to treat and to submit a bill for services. That's the whole context of Rapi Rapi, which then must mean that the patient has the right to accept the sum, even though it may be made. So you see, he can put himself in danger in order to eliminate pain. And that seems to be...
Sorry?
It's about patients. What is it about
patients?
No, this was another matter. It was awful. We have two people at this time. That's the context in Parishishin's book. You have a person who's an older mamazi, who's mid an active battery, and now the victim has a claim. Among the items that he can sue for are medical expenses. And that's based on Rafa Yerapa, because the Gemara becomes the rest of the Rafa, and she says the doctor has the right to treat. Yes, elective surgery. No, it's not about pasture. It may be ulcer, and if it's ulcer, then it may become chavola. Illicit chavola is certainly ulcer. Chavola is served with food is mutter. If this isn't a call for Rafa Yerapa, then it would be illicit, to be sure. But the Moros Tzvi isn't so much worried about the Yisra Chavola. He takes it for granted that there's no Yisra Chavola. He seems to take that for granted, but his problem is that a person has no right to place himself in Sakona. Yisra Chavola is Yitzir because it's served with food. So where is the Yitzir of putting himself in Sakona Yitzir? That's his problem. How to put yourself in Sakona only to improve quality of life. And my answer is correct is that if you take the context of Rafa Yerapa, you see that they were specifically not that. the Torah was not here putting yourself in sakana, even though the purpose of the sakana is not to eliminate a threat to life, only to eliminate the soon. You find a Ramon here, they know Stephen Oben, the racer was also a son. You find a Ramon says that when there's no other race, you can do it, even only to Mok himself. So you see that it's like he was no sakana, there's no figure of message. It's in the context of Stephen Oben, to be sure, but you see that the Rasul was permissible, and he was talking about a situation which it seems to me that there was no sakana, and that seems to be motive even for elimination of self. That doesn't matter. If you show me that I'm mostly say it's mother, that doesn't answer the ultimate question of why it's mother. And it seems to me it's incorporated in Rabbi Rabbi. Yes?
I think it's a
pretty
much similar sort of message where you might have been like that. In other words, so you just said, if the guy dies, so then you're okay. If the guy doesn't die, then I'm stuck up. But you end up with it.
That's not how the Gemara uses the process for the misdemeanor and the truth. Remember, you're working on two levels. You're working on the level of the truth of Mitzvah, and you're working in terms of the growth of Chazal from the process. Chazal did not say that a race day has license to intervene in physiological properties only when the patient's life is in danger. They said that a race day has received and needed it before last time, he is obligated to intervene even when there is only sad. Now, problem. The Ramban tells me that the intervention is always dangerous. What gives him the right to intervene? Answer, it must be the same person, rather than rather. That gives him the right not only to intervene, but also to intervene in a manner that carries with it at least an element of danger. Right? Okay. Let me then go to the other exclusion. And that is the concept of the Gezer. The Ramo in Gilchay Refuah cites earlier sources with regard to certain things that can be withheld from the Gezer. Aval, Yesham Dova, Shagir and Ika Yishia Kanepe, Kigun Shiyesh Tomokoy Kibai Kil Gezer, Kigun Kreti Vaisin, somebody stopping wood, and that prevents the Shiyat on the Shomer, a Shiyesh Melach al Yishayna, is fault on the tongue. They will not be Shiyat on Nefesh, Mutter Lahatira, Shom. They will then ask the Klau Elohimatir on Menea. The off-quoted Ramah saying that withdrawal of treatment is permissible, however permissible only in the case of a basis of enterprise. The Ramah here is carefully distinguishing between an overt act which forced person's life, which in the beginning of the Ramah, which I didn't go through, the Ramah says is also in the case of a basis. However, Hatsora Kamineya is permissible, but permissible only in the case of a basis. In effect, what the Ramo is saying is, there is an obligation of refuah, as you saw last time, it's the fault of Rav Nefe, but there is no obligation of that nature, or at least some things are excluded in the case of a basis. Yes?
Well, it's only by a basis, the concept there,
I know the withdrawal of treatment isn't mutter elsewhere, because if it's mutter elsewhere, then there's never an obligation to cure. And the Machaber began the sermon by saying that the Menei Atzmin is there, so is a shirt of the garment. Now, I know what you mean. What you mean is, sure, there is an obligation to cure when I can cure. But who says there's an obligation to treat when I can't cure? All I can do is prolong life. Right? That's what you meant. Yeah, that's exactly what you meant. How do I know that there is an obligation to treat when the benefit of treatment is not to effect the cure, but only to prolong longevity expectations? Right? My first answer, the short answer for that is that I find around more the mafia, Torah, Kamineya, only in the context of the very truth, nobody else. He didn't tell me as a Hagor and Chief Aleph of the Machaber that the race is not a safe economy if he can't heal but can only prolong life. That's the simple answer. I think that the answer is a little more complex, but I'll try to explain that in a second. First of all, what does this mean? First of all, let me begin with the definition of agreement. If there is a difference between agreement and everybody else, then we have to define agreement. The Machaber in Sif Bey says, The Machaber says that in order to be given, you don't have to hear that the patient is dead. All that you have to hear is that he is agreed. So 72 hours have elapsed since the report of the patient ceases, you can give it, you don't have to do anything else. Let me also point out that in Ebenezer there is a machlokes achronim with regard to the application of this halacha, not for purposes of shiva, but for the purposes of performing a marriage on behalf of the widow of the geitus. If somebody comes and says a man was a geitus 3 months and 3 days ago, for some achronim there is no further evidence of death, and as long as status aleph yerim has elapsed after the expiration of the period of tisa, the woman is permitted to remarry. This then is taken as evidence of the fact that the patient is about to die. One other little point, and then I'll come to the problem, and that is that not here, but elsewhere, both in the patient and the Ebenezer, the Ramo defines the geitus on the basis of a targum. He defines the geitus as somebody who cannot be, somebody who is mala lecho mishnei tsarus hachoda. That is the description. The person who has secretions that he cannot swallow because of the constriction of the thoracic area. He's got the destruction that's supposed in modern terminology because he can't swallow. Now, and that is a sign of quantum of seizure. I suspect that that is not the only symptom that must be present. I presume that we're talking about a person who has lost control of all physical function. And in addition to that, the Machaber says that he is somebody who is going to die within 3 days. Now, my problem is, and of course, this incidentally, the earliest source I'm aware of this Rina Kreva Chagosha says, Yomoyon is a silver of Meram Rattenberg. Let me give you the following hypothetical. We have a patient who is Malulet Nisar Sakhoza, and he's also comatose. He can perform no physical function spontaneously or independently, but he can be kept alive on life support systems for an indefinite period of time. Is this a geitus or is this not a geitus? That's another way of asking whether this definition of gimel yomim is part and parcel of the definition of geitus. Is this a necessary condition or is this simply a criterion that was present in the days of the Machaber and may no longer be present in terms of geitus today? There is a preacher in Yerdeya, on this halacha, who says something to the effect, "In derech shel geitus lichyos yeter migimul yom." To rephrase the point I made before, is ktisa entirely physiological, or is ktisa is it linked to longevity and to space? Such that anybody who can live more than 3 days is not a good. It seems to me, and there are certainly those who disagree, it seems to me that the Machaber in Sif Bey is giving you a necessary condition of sleep. He is saying that anybody who lives more than 3 days is not a good by definition. Otherwise, you would have to take this sheet of Shulchan Aruch and throw it out right now, so it's no longer a club. And I find nobody who says that this halacha doesn't apply. There is in the Yigros Moshe, physical material that you have, somebody went and told him that doctors can no longer define Caesar. And he responded by saying, what do you mean doctors can't define Caesar? The head of the beach in the old country knew when a patient was a basis, they knew all this money. Doctors don't know any less than clever division members. Of course, they know who is a basis and who isn't a basis. And that, of course, is true. Doctors know who is a basis and who isn't a basis. They can give you, they'll tell you. You tell them what the halakhic / clinical criteria of truth are, and they'll tell you whether this patient satisfies those clinical criteria or not. You want to know whether he's not related to Sarah Hoga? That's the easiest thing in the world for a doctor to tell you. However, if you ask the doctor, will this patient survive more than 3 days? There are very few cases in which a doctor will tell you definitively, this patient cannot survive more than 3 days. Or even to say that given the clinical profile of this patient, he belongs to the class of patients such that the majority do not survive more than 72 hours. Yet, there are cases in which the doctor can make that diagnosis. I hear tell that in certain forms of terminal cardiac illness, there is a definitive heartbeat or respiratory pattern or cardiorespiratory pattern or whatever that is definitive feature in heart patients. But that's not where they come to us start. The lesson is about cancer patients, and again, cancer patients, they will more often than not tell you that there's no way that can predict how long the patient can survive, provided that you you provide whatever is available in the little black bag. Now, in effect, let me restate the question. When the Masada says, Mishrimi, Kreva Hodesis, Hayen, Zet, Roshi Yami, who is the Masada talking about? An untreated patient or a treated patient? Is the Masada saying that this patient, if left untreated, will die in 3 days, or is he saying that even if we use everything that's available to medical science, he will nevertheless die in 3 days? It seems to me that the Bahadur is talking about the second, not about the first. Certainly, the point that I made with regard to the Ebenezer side of this case, you come and you say the man 3 months and 3 days ago was a baby, and now I want to know if his wife will have been married. If you're telling me that left untreated he would have died, how do I know that she's not meant to be? Maybe the doctor decided to treat her, and the guy's still living. LMI, if it has any application, means that even if he is treated, he will not survive more than 3 days. That, by definition, is a basis. Now, if that's true, then it means that it may be that there are very few basis around today anymore, because today, medicine can reverse the state of cancer. That doesn't mean I threw out our local Shulchanoro. The law applies. It applies in every case where the doctor can't reverse the state of cancer. When the doctor can reverse the state of cancer, then the patient is no longer a basis. And reversing the state of cancer is reversing only the 72-hour longevity anticipation, because nothing else the doctor can do for this patient. He will not cause him to swallow the laser that he's malignant and sarcoma. That he can't do. All he can do is prolong the life of that patient. Now, if the longevity anticipation is not germane, then the whole halacha has no relevance. If it is germane, then it is extremely relevant. Now, what does that all mean? And let's go back now to the Makaba, and to the Ramor, and what the Ramor is saying with regard to withholding or withdrawal of treatment. Why is there no obligation to treat a patient? Does it mean there's no obligation to treat any terminally ill patient? That is clearly not true. I know it's not true because of the Gemara in Yuma Tehei. That's the classic source, dealing with the person upon whom a wall is falling down, and now the problem is the Mahalashad is the Mahakeah Gal. After the Mahakeah the Gal, he still exists, and certainly the basis, according to the Gemara, say that if he's alive, the Mahakeah the Gal, even if he is only a basis and will only live for a limited period of time. That's the Shri's language, his reference to his earlier Shri's. The Shri's language is quoted in Shri's language, because even though I've shown elsewhere that Chayshin Lechai Shor, and even Machal is always the Sabbath, but the case of the Kruach Adal, we remove the rubble, even though there's still a Sabbath, even though we're not going to cure him. He's terminal. He's moribund. He's a racist. He's going to die. I have an obligation to treat him in order to prolong life. Now, if that's true, then what is Ramo saying here? Ramo says that if a whipple, the topping of the wood, and you can remove the melech of the shema, why is this permissible, and why is this permissible only in the case of a baby? Now here, there are several drachas in our frame. I'm starting with these two shankas. I'm accepting that as the starting point. Two shankas says there's an obligation to treat a basis, even to know how to treat a basis. then what is Ramo saying with regard to this? If I'm a Pateh Pagal, then why shouldn't I be obligated to keep on chopping wood? That keeps them alive, isn't it? I'm chopping wood, and I'm keeping the patient alive by chopping the wood. That's a refuah. It's not a refuah, it at least serves to prolong longevity. Why am I not obligated to do so? I see two ways in offering. First, Rav Oldenburg says, and the Ramad Rochel, and Tito Yos in one place, he distinguishes between Tisa and Gemara Yisya Kanefesh. Yes, I have to treat a basis, but I don't have to treat, and maybe it's also to treat, when we're dealing with Gemara Yisya Kanefesh. That's his phrase. I don't know what it means. Nor do I know any sources for it. There are more than say Gemara Yisya Kanefesh in the context of the basis. I have difficulty conceptually distinguishing between various bases. There are others who understand the Rambo as being limited to a concept that we found last time, namely Tegulim, in Yoni Tegulim. There's the Shuva of Rav Rivas in the Beis Ovi, in which he makes the point, maybe not as directly and as explicitly as one would prefer. I always thought that was Stat Narambo, and Rav Yankee Kamevsky, the friend of Rocha, told me that he assumes it was a double portrait, that the Rambo is talking only about the withholding of Segulas as distinct from medical remedies. Now, look at what Rambo is talking about. He's talking about chopping wood and melanoma. No doctor has ever explained to me how wood chopping keeps people alive or what medical efficacy there is in soul insofar as keeping people alive is concerned. Remember the last time, we already defined a schooler as distinct from a refuah. One is something with regard to which there is a cause and effect relationship that can be explained in physical or chemical terms, and the other is metaphysics or whatever. If this is correct, then there are more sense to the proposition. You have to treat everybody, every moribund patient, even a basis. The only person that you cannot treat is a basis, and the only thing that you can withhold from him is a segula, but not a known refuah. And of course, there could then be no question about withholding oxygen or intravenous or respirators or what have you from a basis. That's only one way to learn the Rambam. There's another way. Yes.
Why is it so obvious that these things have medical value? Or rather, how long do they live?
I never said that it has no medical value. I said that the efficacy is not known on the basis of scientific knowledge.
Okay. I don't understand. I mean, I think
the two doctors here are going to be
the things that
are bothersome to the basis. The basis who is being kept alive on a respirator is being kept alive in a way that is bothersome to him. It is an equal with your Siyas and Shoma, and that by definition is painful.
So is that
what is painful?
No, that means that he puts pain on the patient.
Also for long as life.
No, I don't mean that. I mean that for a moment or two, is there such a thing as dying peacefully?
Is there such a thing as dying peacefully? No. You see if an effort is always unpeaceful. You see if the strong is unpeaceful, unless it's peaceful.
I don't know, I think
this is
a whole thing
that I'm talking about. Remember, our most assumption is that prolongation of the dying process, to borrow that phrase, is burdensome to the patient. Equal to Siyat HaNefesh is burdensome to the patient. Yes.
That
is the most important question.
Yeah.
And therefore, if there's no obligation to do this, why burden the patient? Or at least there's no obligation to burden the patient. Incidentally, let me make that point right now. There are two problems with Rambo. One is that I'm more talking about only men's name or everything. B, is that I'm more saying this is permissible, or is that I'm more saying that you're not allowed to stop when a guy dies? Is it also? Okay? Now, both of those points are the subject of considerable disagreement. I began with the Shushankir for a number of reasons. The Shushankir says that it's obligated to treat a patient, and then you have to say that I'm more either talking about Gemara Yisya Nefesh or Yom Tzibulim. And then we come to the question of whether even these things are mutter or awesome. Rav Moshe thinks they're also not just that they are obligatory, but they're also Rav Moshe. Yeah, Rav Moshe also thinks it's also to give a gracious medicine. That it's also to prolong the life of the race, even using medication. The Mishnah Brewer in the Vira Halacha and Shin Chofer seems to me to be saying that you have an obligation to free the patient, even if he's a ghost. So that you have that basic problem. You have to refer to Moshe, the Yulian Mashiach brings the Shevyanki, the disagree with the Shushanki, and I'll play with the Shevyanki, and the Shushanki, what you're permitted to be married for the life of the race, and that goes squarely to the Ramah. Yes. And so you have to. Well, we have to recognize that a basis is a category of halal. I don't think Rav Moshe accepted my definition of a basis either. That's another problem. If you don't accept that definition of basis, then you're saying that a person can survive for more than 3 days and still a basis. Now the problem is how do you define food? That becomes a much more difficult problem. Yes. Yes.
Why is it possible? Why was saying he's not, you know, they are not
moving from there. Why? The question is even more fundamental. Why is this is not hazardous and there's no philosophic involved? Why isn't there an obligation to keep a basis alive as long as possible? An absolute obligation under any and all circumstances. Now, as I understand this, and you'll have to pardon my rough analogy, as I understand it, there is a limitation on rapa yurapa. The limitation of rapa yurapa, and I'll use terms that I dislike because it's the only way I can explain it, then I'll explain what I mean using the term. There is an obligation to treat, but there's no obligation to prolong the process of dying. That's a very modern concept within, and the way it's used out there, if you don't want to do something, then you call it prolonging dying. If you want to do it, then you talk about it as prolonging life. That's exactly how the terms are used. In halacha, you've got to define these things precisely. I think that I can define this if you have to allow me a kind of a marker. It seems to me that what Chazal are telling us in these halacha is that there's an absolute obligation to cure. There's an absolute obligation to prolong life. There is perhaps a prohibition against prolonging death, and certainly no obligation to prolong death. What does it mean to prolong death? Very simple. When the Malach HaMoves begins to die, you have no longer, both of the dawn, no longer has any obligation. You may even have a cure. You see, I don't mess with Malach. When Malach takes over, it's time for humans to retire. They certainly have no obligation to intervene. I also see reflected in the halacha the principle that the Malach HaMoves gets a time limit. He is given 72 hours to do his job, never more than 72 hours. So that if you're dealing with somebody who's going to live more than 72 hours, you know the Malach HaMoves isn't working because he's very efficient. He works within his allotted time span. If this guy can live more than 72 hours, you know the Malach HaMoves isn't there. Now, one more point, and that is, that's not absolute. Because there are times when you can interfere with a Malach HaMoves, and that's my untreated basis. If somebody is bleeding from an artery, I know very well that if I don't apply the tourniquet, the Malach HaMoves is going to do his job. Does that mean that I have no obligation to apply a tourniquet? I absolutely do. This guy untreated is going to die in a minute, not an hour. Do I have an obligation to apply a tourniquet? Absolutely. What does that mean? And if I don't apply the tourniquet, the Malach HaMoves works. If I do apply the tourniquet, the Malach HaMoves doesn't work. Or the Malach HaMoves comes only when I don't apply the tourniquet. What it means is the Malach HaMoves is here. But when I can take the Malach HaMoves by the scruff of the neck and throw him out, I have an obligation to do so. When all that I can do is interfere with the Malach HaMoves, I have no obligation, and maybe even interfere. The crucial question is, can I reverse the process of teaching? Reversing the process of teaching means I'm throwing the Malach HaMoves out of the room. Then I am obligated. But if I can't succeed in throwing out of the room, all I can do is impede him and make him work a little bit longer, I have no obligation, I may be even an issue. Which then means, given everything I've said before, if the patient can live more than 72 hours, then that's proof positive that it's within my power to throw the malachim off the bowel. If the patient cannot live even with my intervention for the 72 hours, then that's proof positive that I cannot throw the malachim off the bowel. At that point, either it's also for me to do anything, or it's certainly not obligatory. And that's the key of the correct method. That's going to be rapid and rapid. It's with Samad Amriyah. The Samad Amriyah for me, that I have an obligation to intervene when the Malachim Oved is going to keep on anyway. I'm sorry, I didn't say it the wrong way. I have an obligation to intervene except when the Malachim Oved is going to keep on anyway. When the Malachim Oved is going to keep on anyway, there's no Samad Amriyah. And it may even be yours. Yes?
More in terms of
the
patient, but
No. The fact that it is painful means only for the eighth ring that if there's no obligation, then why are you causing the person to start for no good reason? That's the basic point. If there is no obligation, then why are you being very certain start? It now becomes us that the very start for no reason. When there's no fear, the correct method is don't be very start. The ones who disagree, and there's a long list to disagree, those contain, one have nothing to do with the other. I have no obligation to intervene, but there's no use to intervene either. And therefore, if I have intervened, it's missed.
When you're
good. Yeah, even the case of the day. Even the case of the day. Those are schools. And again, the school law has no obligation, and arguably even an interest, depending upon which of these are to be regarded as when there are more correct. Now, this then means, insofar as the treatment of a basis is concerned, that A, you have to have definition of the basis. B, you have to know what it is that you can be nimeya from a basis. Is the Ramah talking about everything, or is the Ramah talking about only in Yoni Suguri? And that both of those things seem to be the subject of some controversy in our framing. We don't have much time left, but one point that I should make, and that is, what about food, water, intravenous, oxygen, blood? Is that any different? And here too, the ordinary reaction, or seems the obvious reaction, seems to me to be that there is no difference between food and an aspirin, or water and penicillin. If I have an obligation to cook method, the obligation to cook method is no different with regard to providing bread and water than it is with regard to providing a medicine. Reflection distinguishes between them, and I don't have time to talk about it in any great length. We seem to think that you can't treat a patient medically, you can't treat a basis medically, but that you do have an obligation to give him food and water. At one point, it seems to say because withholding food and water is going to cause even more scars to the basis. I'm not sure if that's medically correct. That's another entirely different topic that I certainly don't have time to explore. It was from the Zalman in the Masha Eliyahu, he says that there is an obligation, there's no obligation to treat a basis, or at least from circumstances, there's no obligation to treat a basis. He says, but the staff role, you have to give him mind and emotion. I can show you other sources that say there's no difference between mind and emotion and meditation. One of them is proven in the Abdullah. One point that I must talk about, even though we're over time, and that's the problem, is concept of Yisur. We've been talking about the Ramor, and the fact that Ramor clearly talks about Yisur in terms of the ma'akid Yisur Kenefesh, and that's the question of whether Yisur themselves are sufficient reason to withhold treatment, not necessarily limited to the case of the basis, but in general. And Rav Moshe clearly thinks that the treatment of not treating basis is limited to Yisur, and limited to Yisur. Is because a basis by definition suffers Yisurim. He also, consistently with his position, says that you should not treat a moribund patient who cannot be cured, whose life can simply be prolonged, if he is in Yisurim and doesn't want to be treated. He says that you do have to treat him if you can save his life and cure him thereby, and that you should treat him if he wants to be treated, but that you shouldn't treat him if he is suffering Yisurim and doesn't want to be treated. Now, the point that Rav Moshe makes in theory is very cogent. In the real world, I'm not sure. In theory, I understand exactly what Rav Moshe means. And for that, I have to use another proof in Rav Moshe. and he's not that there too. At the end of the Cuban heart transplant, he was asked a question with regard to autopsy, whether you need consent of next of kin. And we truly do have a little history. There's an article published by Manuel Yukovic in an early issue of Thursday about that on autopsy. It was at the height of the autopsy controversy in American soil when the religious parties were pressing for an amendment to the Pathology Act that would require consent of next of kin. And Rabbi Kovic goes to emerge and says, what is the business of next of kin? Who needs consent of next of kin? If Muslim is a corrupt method, then it's Muslim. And you don't need consent of next of kin. If it's awesome, then consent of next of kin doesn't make any difference. So why is he asking for consent of next of kin? Now everybody knows why they were asking for consent of next of kin, because the Knesset was not about to enact the Yerdeya as the Chofet Knesset. And the model, the paradigm, was what happens in a democratic society. In a democratic society, you need consent for an autopsy, and the pathologist can do it without permission, and obviously, the craving, if they are trained to theory in history, will go to the Rav Shiloh, and the Rav will tell them when it's mutter and when it's after, and they'll tell them that it's mutter, it's not only mutter, but it's a field, so you can't refuse the consent. And this is only the vehicle by which you can introduce the categories of halakha. But you know, on the surface, it doesn't make sense in halakha. Why are you asking for consent of next of kin? You want the chok, what's the chok say? The most important method, you don't need consent of next of kin. The real reason is you don't trust the pathology to tell us what is pikuach nefes and what is pikuach nefes. And that's really what was going on. And Rabbi Kovach's report will make a good answer. Fine, we'll make it a thousand. Lo and behold, years later, when this was published, you have the Shuvanidus Mason, which the Mason says that as a matter of how often you always need consent of next of kin. You can never do an autopsy, even the Mokins to the Ghost Method, without consent of next of kin, for very good reasons in halacha. What are the good reasons in halacha? We found that Amriyaka was Machloikas of Eishkin, whether you treat it as a mitzvah assay, and since it requires no verdict, and the seed is only claimed as Machloikin, or whether it's like any other law, even though here it requires no verdict, for Shum, and therefore the Mechuyit even call Memeinah. But nobody says that you're obligated to more than call Memeinah. You never have to spend more than call Memeinah to save a person's life. The same point is made by the Baruch Cook and the Daf Kali and the Serial Mepakish in a different context. It's axiomatic. Kruach Nefesh is Mechayit no more than call Memeinah, but not more than call Memeinah. Says the Moshe, there can be circumstances in which craving will say that the desires, evil and mess to them are more than called the Menon, and they refuse to give consent legitimately. Says the Moshe, of course, when it comes back to Shiloh, you should tell them that it's entirely proper to give consent, they should give consent, and they should be Mavaster under the desires, whatever, who knows what we should do with. But if they still claim that the desires are more than called the Menon, they're not before you to do so. I don't want to analyze that too, but I have problems with it. In this context, I have problems. I have problems with the autopsy situation. I'm not sure that the clergy are balabatim to say that their Brazilian has anything to do with it. To put it aside, the principle is an obvious principle, and it has applications into Kruach Nefesh as well. It may well be the case that Yisurim are more than Kol Memeinah. If you're dealing with a situation, if the patient says that the spirit that he gives you his entire fortune and more in order to eliminate the excruciating pain that he is suffering and be allowed to die in peace, then he's Yisurim are more than Kol Memeinah, and he has no obligation to suffer such Yisurim in order to live. There's no evil in Tamil Gamayapa under those circumstances. If a rally is necessary, I have a teaching of the best in Subic, cases in several places in Africa, and I'm sure Vazari, the Gemara says, that had they been tortured, they would have served under the Zohar. They had no tools, they had no tools, also went down. The patient says, how could that possibly be? It's yours, on Yahweh. The patient gives to him. And the chief answers, in effect, that yours by Yahweh is that, but no more. Yours by Yahweh, the Yisurim, are more than one. I'm pleased to say the Yisurim put before for the Zaveris. I'm sorry, I'm pleased to sacrifice my life rather than the Yisurim, but I'm not pleased to suffer the Yisurim. The Yisurim are more than one. Under those circumstances, it may well be the case that the Kehle has no such obligation. Now, Ramesha doesn't spell this out clearly. These are long sutras, and in terms of the reasoning and the arguments of halakha, there's very little there. He does not spell out the reasons clearly and precisely. It seems to me, and there was a time when I hesitated to say this at all, for fear of abuse, and therefore in Judaism and healing, this is buried in a two-line footnote, because it's very easy for a doctor to say that the serum is terrible and excruciating, and therefore we don't have to treat the patient. However, once these statements are floating around saying that you not only aren't obligated, but you dare not treat a patient without his consent when he is suffering, I think that has to be put into a certain context. And this is the context in which it seems to me that it's chosen. When the Syrian are such that they are excruciating and the patient would say, I give you my entire fortune to be spared such a Syrian, I think there are strong grounds for withdrawing treatment, even if the patient is not obligated. However, in the real world, it seems to me that such cases are few and far between. And I'm not going to enter into discussion of clinical conditions in which it may be, or at least let me amend that statement. There are few conditions. The conditions in which this has to be the case are few and far between. I know that there are many patients who are not treated for pain. That's for medical reasons, reasons of medical management, rather than anything else. There are painkillers that are available that can control virtually all pain, if not all pain. Doctors don't like to use them. They don't want to use heroin because it's illegal. There's no question in my mind that my father says that there's nothing that was clearly without a purpose, and the world proceeds to explain the reason, the purpose for a whole lot of things that don't seem to have any purpose. No one asks them really what heroin was created for. They go ask me what was heroin created for. It was created to deal with the intractable pain of terminal cancer patients. Now, you don't even have to use heroin. There are other things available. You use morphine. Morphine will work. There's only one danger with morphine. If you give a morphine to a patient to control pain, you have to keep on increasing the dosage. If you keep on increasing doses, it suppresses the respiratory center in the brain. That result is the patient can't breathe and less. Sure, he doesn't go into respiratory arrest, and my answer is a shrug of the shoulder, so be it, and do so. Give him whatever you have to give him, monitor him, and ultimately put him on the respirator. You can control that pain. And if you can control that pain, then it seems to me you cannot plead that the pain, which now exists because it hasn't been managed properly, is sufficient reason to withhold treatment that will prolong life. Eliminate the pain, and then prolong the life. However, theoretically, and indeed in some rare clinical circumstances, there may be no way to control pain. Under those circumstances, I think the point is extremely well taken. Those extreme are more than comorbid, and hence it needs a fourth category in which there is no in which withdrawal of treatment is permissible. It seems to me that category is the extreme of a magnitude such that they constitute more than comorbid. I think we've got to stop. Thank you.